Good afternoon and welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Scott Greeson, director of Friends of the Eel River. The Eco News Report is an exclusive feature of KHSU brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, the Eco News. Don't forget, you can find this show and other KHSU public affairs shows on the audio archives page at khsu.org. We humans like to think of landscapes as the immutable backdrop to our busy little stories. Maybe it's only natural that we tend to think of the parts of the landscape that we've built in the same way as permanent fixtures. But now and then we're reminded that landscapes only seem immutable, that even our greatest works are subject to, and often powerless before, the irresistible forces that nature can bring to bear. Over the past few weeks, much of California has been riveted by the near failure of at least big parts of the state's tallest dam, the massive Oroville Dam. 188,000 people were evacuated on just hours' notice from their homes along the Feather River below the dam. My guest today is Michael Jacobell. Michael's a longtime environmental activist who's become a filmmaker. He visited the Oroville Dam site just last week as the situation began to come under control. We're going to look at what happened at the Oroville Dam and talk about how those events shed light on broader questions about aging dams and failing flood control structures around the state and across the country, and about the challenges ahead in meeting rising, often conflicting demands in the face of a changing climate. So welcome to the Eco News Report, Michael.
All right. Thanks for having me.
I guess my first question is, what drives you to get in the face of a monster like that half-wrecked Oroville Dam spillway and the enormous waves coming down it? I mean, that just seems like a reckless thing to do.
Well, if you saw my photos, it looks like you're standing on the surf with on the edge of the beach with a giant tsunami coming at you.
But that
with a 200-millimeter lens. I was across the river, plenty safe.
So there really wasn't any risk at all?
For me, no. Okay. Not at all.
My memory says that by the time you got there, the situation was no longer desperate, but it was just beginning to really come under control. What did you see when you got to Oroville?
Yeah, that's basically correct. So I went there with a journalist friend. She's a foreign correspondent for a German paper. And so she has a formal press pass. So we were able to get a few places that the public couldn't go, not up on top of the dam, unfortunately, or some where the work was taking place. But we had a good view of a lot of it. So what had happened, you know, real brief timeline for those who didn't follow it is February 7th, the spillway is this gigantic 3,000-foot long concrete chute that's about as wide as I-5. I don't know exactly how wide. It's gigantic. It's hard to imagine.
It looks like a stretch of concrete freeway that's bent just a little bit in the middle to go a little steeper.
Yeah, it's huge. And, you know, they were dumping all the excess stormwater, you know, the rainwater from this heavy winter storms that would have more than filled up the dam. So they were dumping the excess like they normally do. And somebody noticed in that flow at one point on the 7th that there was something irregular. It was just shooting up, you know, there's turbulence. It was shooting up a rooster tail.
There were waves shooting up instead of just cruising down the freeway.
Yeah, waves shooting up. Yeah. And then chunks of, somebody was nearby and got a cell phone video. It was really dramatic. If you probably look around on YouTube and find it, but it was chunks of concrete flying out. Anyway, they shut the spillway down, and there was a big giant hole in the middle of it where it had cavitated and started blowing out. So what they did is they just left it shut. The dam was already relatively close to full. It filled up very quickly, and they started using what's called the emergency spillway. They've started calling it the auxiliary spillway.
Just as they started to use it, it turned into the auxiliary spillway.
Yeah. Exactly. So anyway,
and this was the first time they'd ever used the now auxiliary spillway.
Right. Because the dam had never been that full. They almost used it, apparently, in 1997. They didn't need to.
And so, let's just set up the physical scenario a little bit. The Oroville Dam, as I mentioned, is incredibly tall. It's an earthen dam, an embankment. But it's set up between basically two chunks of mountain, two big pieces of rock. And next, on the other side of one of those big pieces of rock, are these spillways.
Right.
And they're both actually a little bit lower than the main dam itself, so that water will spill over the side rather than go over the dam and cripple it.
Exactly. And if you on the north edge of the dam, it's anchored to a rock ridge, and then just on the other side of that is the main spillway. It's this large structure that has
gates
called the head gates, but these big gates that open and close, and they can let water out or keep it in as they want. And then if you go farther north, there's the auxiliary spillway, which is which is a 30-foot-high concrete berm that runs along the ridgetop, and that's lower, as you said, than the height of the dam. The base of the main spillway is even lower than that.
Right.
I'm not sure how low, but, you know, at least probably 30, 40 feet lower or something. It looks quite a bit lower. And that's so that they can, you know, let water out and keep the water level well below. Well, it's actually 50 feet below lower at least, because that's how low the lake level is now.
Right.
So when they started letting water over the auxiliary spillway, unlike the main spillway that's concrete all the way down to the Feather River Canyon, 3,000 linear feet, not right. vertical feet. It's like 800 right. vertical feet below. That one is just dirt. It's this 30-foot concrete berm along the ridgetop, and below that it's just dirt. And it started eroding away and threatened to undermine. It eroded away faster than they thought. Threatened to undermine the auxiliary spillway. And had it done so, had that collapse, there would have essentially been a 30-foot uncontrollable wall of water headed down the canyon. There was no
basically
way to control.
The top 30 feet of this enormous reservoir.
Yeah, 25 yeah. square miles,
yeah.
30 feet deep, would yeah. have been, you know, raced down the canyon uncontrollably. Until the, you know, winter rains stopped and the snow melt stopped, and you know, the summer drought just naturally lowered the lake and they could deal with it. But so anyway, so what was happening is that when they saw that happening, that's when they issued the 1-hour evacuation. They went, uh-oh, this is bad. What they did then immediately is they took the risk of opening the main spillway gates, because the auxiliary spillway was almost a certain failure at that point.
It was running, I think, 12,000, something like 12,000 CFS when it was designed to be able to handle 250,000 CFS. But as you said, the erosion was already threatening to cut the lip out from under the whole auxiliary structure. It just failed completely soon as it started being used. And so back to the main spillway, they turned that on full blast, knowing they're going to wreck the spillway.
100,000 cubic feet per second.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so here was the risk is, if you look at a cross-section of the spillway, right, you look at it crossways, where it comes out of the main head gates, it's relatively flat. It goes down a ways. I don't have the exact numbers, but it goes down a ways, and then it bends and goes steeper down into the canyon.
Right. And that's
the inflection point.
It's just after that that it failed.
Yeah. Right, just after that it failed. And the key, and so the risk here is that failure, the collapse of the main spillway structure, would have kept working its way back up the flow, up toward the main head gate. And had the main head gate failed, then you would have, again, you'd have this big gaping hole in the top of the ridge, not in the dam, but in the ridge next to the dam, you know, a few hundred feet away, that would be releasing that 25 square miles worth of water until it hit enough bedrock that it quit cutting down more. So they had to take they had to take a risk there. Now, at that point, the main spillway, they were letting out about 50,000 or 55,000 cubic feet per second, and it had been holding stable. They had reopened it and had been letting that much water out. It hadn't been eroding much more, so they really had no choice, and they just had to cross their fingers that the extra 100,000, you know, cubic feet per second increase, or the increase to that, wasn't going to cause the whole main spillway to just zipper up the ridge. And it didn't. It stayed pretty stable. What blew out, and what the dramatic photos, the ones I took and the ones a lot of people have seen on social media or in the news, are of the lower part of the main spillway, way down by the last, you know, I don't know, probably 300-400 feet in vertical elevation down to the river. And that's where, because once it breached the spillway, it just left it entirely and carved a giant new canyon,
right.
Its own new channel right into the mountainside. That, at that point, that's, I don't know, it's a couple thousand feet, probably quarter mile or something, maybe, away from the base of the dam. That's a huge bedrock ridge it would have had to cut through to get to the dam at that point. So it at no point was it actually threatening the integrity of the dam, despite the dramatic photos, despite
right.
what it looked like.
And the risk of a truly catastrophic scenario isn't the same as a total failure of the dam. What we're talking about is the potentially catastrophic failure of the emergency spillway,
right.
and just that side of it. So one of the problems they encountered here is that the usual way they let water, and when we say they, we mean the Division of Water Resources, the state agency that owns and manages the Oroville Dam. The usual way they're letting water out of that structure is with turbines at the bottom of it. And in the course of, and that's because they want to get power made if they're releasing water. They're only going to spill water using the spillway if they have to make room for floodwaters. And of course, there's big storms coming in, so they did have to make room for floodwaters. But as part of this disaster or near disaster, there was so much gunk in the river that the river backed up to the point where they couldn't run the turbines. So you couldn't even use the usual way to let the dam out.
Though the turbines only run will only release about 14,000 CFS.
Right.
Okay, so not a huge amount when you're talking about 100,000 coming down the main spillway. But still.
But usually that's what is the main way that they're letting water out is, you know, that way they're letting water out, which, and we should say that and this gets to some of these issues. The main reason that Oroville Dam is there is to provide water to Southern California, to a group of about 20 state water contractor agencies, including the main Los Angeles contractor. You know, there's a big question now about who's going to pay to fix this. And of course, the entities that get this water are supposed to pay to fix it. But one of the lasting lessons of California politics is pay attention to who pays for water, because it's often not who seems to be paying for water. So there's a conflict coming up where we're going to see the water contractors pushing to have the state carry those costs to repair the dam and basically make all the state citizens pay for it. But there's another purpose to these dams, which is flood control. And, you know, there's, I think, a way in which this incident really highlights the conflict between those two things, because the state water contractors are putting huge pressure on the Division of Water Resources to give them as much water as possible in this wet year after 5 years of drought. So they're trying to keep the dam full. And that's why we wound up with water up to the brim, which is usually how they run.
Well, they say, again, I really didn't pay much attention to Oroville Dam before this.
Right.
But what they've been saying is that, so right now they've using the main spillway, which they closed off and dried up today. And so if you look around on news or social media, you can see photos of the damage now that the water stopped temporarily. But they've lowered the reservoir to about 50 feet or so below the top of the emergency spillway.
Right.
That was their target. That gives them a huge storm surge. They can, you know, we can have a massive storm or massive amount of runoff, and the lake can now absorb that without having to overflow again. What they've been saying is that that's how they usually manage it.
Right.
They say that's their usual cushion. Then they'll let it fill up as the last of the runoff comes in. They'll probably let that fill up. I don't really know the details, but my question was, you know, why did they let it get so full in the first place? Why was it so close to the top that shutting the main spillway for a few days caused it to overtop?
We don't know the answer to that yet, but my strong suspicion is it's related to that the overpowering thirst. And again, it's not just cities. Some of those water contractors are agricultural water districts.
Well, we know there's going to be an enormous investigation into all this, so I'm sure all those little details will come out eventually.
But. Yeah. If you're just tuning in, this is the Eco News Report. I'm Scott Greeson. I'm with Friends of the Eel River, and I'm talking with Mike Jacoble, filmmaker and environmental activist. We've been talking about, you know, what happened at Oroville Dam and the combination of flood and management issues and really just straight up infrastructure failure that we see there. But there are, I think, some broader issues that we haven't actually heard talked about in this situation. One is straight up seismic safety. Are these structures safe in a major earthquake? And second, implicit in this whole story is questions about aging and decaying infrastructure. The Oroville Dam is actually not very old, as California dams go. It's a relatively recent dam, younger than many, many dams, including our Eel River dams, which are roughly a century old. But, you know, one thing I've just learned recently is that not only aren't the levees in the Sacramento area and on the Feather River downstream of Oroville not seismically safe, neither is the Oroville Dam. But, you know, this points to the kind of issues we have across the state. And, you know, this is something that's really important to us, Friends of the Eel River, because we're looking at especially Scott Dam, the upper dam on the Eel River. It was built on a fault. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And, well, it... You know, we didn't even know what faults were when we built that dam.
100 years ago, right?
Yeah. We didn't know what plate tectonics were. We didn't know that there are big chunks of the earth that slide past each other. But if you think about it, the places where the earth slides past each other, where those intersect a river canyon, that river canyon's going to get narrower as those plates slide together. Turns out that's where we built a lot of dams, is on those notches where river canyons get narrow. One of them is Scott Dam, which forms the Lake Pillsbury Reservoir in the Upper Eel. And that's a big concern because it sure looks like that's a dam that could fail completely with a good shake.
So this whole question of the dam and these giant excesses of water that we have now bring up a number of questions that I think you could probably speak to a lot better. But one is the effect of climate change on California's plumbing and water delivery system. Do you have any thoughts on that?
One, it's really important to start with an understanding of where we sit against the broader history of California's climate, and we are just beginning to understand what that really looks like. And the short answer there is that it looks like our very recent history, the European history of California, has come during a nice, wet, mild time. And if you look back further in the last 1,000, 2,000 years, it's very clear that the range of variability in our climate is actually much greater than we've experienced in the last 150, 200 years on the West Coast. So there have been much longer and hotter droughts than the one we've already experienced, and there have been atmospheric river events that make the last couple of months look like a garden hose. So just one little piece of that history is the 1862 floods that left the entire Central Valley under 17 feet of water for the entire summer. Sacramento didn't dry out that whole year. They moved the capital to San Francisco. It destroyed the then existing ranching industry. So there's a lot to say about just that picture. So having said that, we already know that we live in a place that is much more variable than we thought. Climate change is going to amp that up. Climate change is very likely to bring an even larger range of extremes. We're likely to see hotter droughts and longer droughts, but we're also likely to see more intense rainfall events. The other big thing, though, that water supply folks are always harping on is that as global warming continues, we're losing the California snowpack. And most of our water storage has been in snow, not in dams. And so as we move into a warmer climate, we're going to get a lot more water early in spring as water, as rain, and not as snow. And so we're going to have to come up with ways to try to, you know, spread out those peaks.
Right. Well, that's where groundwater storage as opposed to more reservoirs comes in. Because this massive runoff we're having right now that's causing floods, a lot of that, you know, it's going right to the ocean, you know, where it's necessary, of course. But, you know, a lot of that could be captured in groundwater more effectively than it could be captured in reservoirs that are all full right now.
There's a lot of reason to think that. But right now, it's very clear that there's a political fix in to build two new dams with the money that California voters approved in the last water bond, the Prop 1 water bond. One will be at Temperance Flat, the other at Sites, which is basically just over the Coast Range on the west side of the Sacramento in Tehama Valley. And there's even some sort of long-term concern that if Sites is built, we could see North Coast rivers piped over to fill that. That seems a very, very, very unlikely scenario, but, you know, it's there. I think the bigger concern from sort of broad North State point of view is that if the so-called Twin Tunnels California Water Fix proposal goes through and those tunnels get built, then there's going to be a structure that will convey so much water to the south that basically in the future the state will be tempted to use it all the time, whether the water is actually available or not. It does seem like we should be spending that money on groundwater storage, but right now it doesn't look like the political will is there. You know, the other problem is that we know a fair amount about how to pump aquifers dry, but it's less clear how to get them to fill up again, other than filling up Tulare Lake again and letting it sit there. The other problem is that once you pump an aquifer too much, they can just collapse. And where you see subsidence across the Central Valley, and we've seen a lot of subsidence in the last 5 years, you can't just pump those things back up. You can't get water back into those holes. You raised a really important set of points, Michael, when we were talking before the show about how we respond to emergency situations broadly. And, you know, that was, it must have been absolutely terrifying for people who were downstream of the Oroville Dam when they got, you know, the word that they had to evacuate in an hour. Yeah. But, you know, here on the North Coast, we all face the reality that we could have a Category 8 or 9 earthquake anytime. What are good practices in a crisis like that?
When I first heard about the Oroville Dam, for a while I was watching the helicopter news cams and, you know, and on my phone and watching, you know, something else on my laptop. And I was watching what was going on social media. And when they issued the evacuation notice, really quickly, social media, which is probably where most people were going to get their information on this as they were evacuating, as they were in the process or wondering what they should do, where they should go, it became basically noise with bad information. And it was really hard to find out unless you could calmly, as I was, sit at the table with a laptop in one hand and a phone in the other and go through multiple sources. It was really hard to find what was valid information, you know, what you should do, who should evacuate, where you should go, because people were sharing bad information, basically.
It sounds like what people tend to do is focus on threat, and worst case scenarios really grab our attention. So we tend to propagate those kinds of concerns without really thinking about what we're doing by, you know, repeating these kind of messages.
Right, which is exactly the last thing you want to do, because when you have an emergency evacuation, I mean, it's one thing when you've got, say, a flood that's, you know, predicted, you know, a day or two in advance kind of thing. We know there's a big storm coming. You have time to get ready. But in this case, it was a 1 hour get out. The roads are already jammed. There's, you know, limited resources. And it's really important that those resources get to the people who need them. It's important that the roads are only jammed with the people who really truly are in danger, not with people from, you know, miles away who can just safely sit at home and relax because it's not a problem. I think it's just really important that if you're in a situation like that, especially if it's not affecting you immediately, you verify everything three times before you share it on social media. You make sure that your information is good. And if you're not sure, don't share it. Look for sources of official information or something else that you can verify, that you can back up.
Those are really good points. We've already heard a couple of things from state authorities, Jerry Brown and other folks in the state of California, about how to respond to this. One of the things that the state is actually proposing is requiring state-licensed dams to have what's called an emergency plan that says what could happen if this dam or parts of it fail, who could get inundated, and what happens to those people. And those plans are actually required already for federally licensed dams. There's a real problem, though, which is that those plans are not public. They're kept confidential as critical energy infrastructure information. Basically, it's terrorist sensitive. You know, kind of a mixed blessing there. I mean, it makes sense to have emergency plans, but it would make, I think, a lot more sense to have emergency plans that the public knew about and could pay attention to and participate in.
I think, you know, part of the reason is because you think about that. If they say an inundation area map of Oroville Dam, because that's a gigantic amount of water back there. So the map is out there that shows if the dam completely failed, which wasn't a risk at this point. That was not what was happening now. But if it completely failed, there was a huge area of the delta that would be under a very lot of water for a very long time. And it just, you think about what that would do to things like insurance and real estate prices and so on. It would
Billions.
It would cost billions. And the fact is, that's a super worst case scenario. It's probably not going to happen. Good, but it's probably not. But if you did that for every single dam, it would cost a lot of money. It would freak a lot of people out. And I think that's, you know, it's one of these things. It's really easy for people, if you read the warning label on something like aspirin or ibuprofen, there's all sorts of things that can cause. And yeah, if, you know, a million people take this, there are a couple that, you know, will have this terrible side effect. But, you know, I think that's what we're, you know, you're looking at. They don't want to have people go, oh my God, this whole place, we can't live anywhere near here. We can't do anything here. look at these terrible things that were going to happen, because most people don't have really understand risk assessment.
That's a, I think, a pretty generous take on why those plans are secret. My own take is that the dam owners would rather people didn't know that there's such significant risks entailed in living downstream from a poorly maintained dam. Just a note for folks in the Eel River, the fact that we can't look at, though the sheriffs have a copy of, the emergency plan for the Eel River dams really doesn't freak us out that badly, because we actually know what a really big flood on the Eel looks like. The 64 flood was actually a lot more water than would be released by just a total failure of the two Eel River dams. Now, if they released in the course of a big flood, that's a different thing. But point is, we already know what a big flood looks like, and it's, you know, water up to the middle of those trees.
And county planning since then has taken that into account.
There's to some extent,
still there is a limit to what you can build and do in the 64 floodplain some extent.
Yeah.
How about the dam that holds back Ruth Lake?
If that were to go
catastrophically in one big chunk,
then a lot of the Arcata Bottoms is underwater. A lot of water. That's actually a much bigger risk in some ways. But we get a lot of warning, hours and hours of warning time. It's potentially a real risk. But from what I know of the Ruth Lake Dam, it's not itself structurally questionable in any way. It's probably pretty safe. Thanks again for coming in.
Yeah, sure.
This has been the Eco News Report. My name is Scott Greason. I've been your host for the past half hour. I've been speaking with Mike Jackable. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. You can hear this broadcast again on the archive programs page of the station's website at khsu.org. The Eco News Report is produced at Humboldt State University in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Tune in again next week at the same time for the Eco News Report.